Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. Scott Klusendorf joins us for the first half. He's director of bioethics for Standard Reason based in Signal Hill, California. The first part of our conversation, what can the average person, I mean, everyone thinks of themselves in some sense as the average person. What can the average person do to stop abortion? I remember thinking this when, well, before I had access to this microphone. Now that I have access to it, people give me all sorts of credit for doing all sorts of things and saying all sorts of things that usually it's my guest who's saying the bright things, especially on the pro-life issue. I just sit here and talk to them. What can the average person do to stop abortion? And a little later in our conversation with Scott, talking points on abortion. If, let's see, I don't know if either side in the presidential elections campaign really want to talk about abortion, but chances are it's going to come up. If Scott were writing talking points for President George W. Bush, ostensibly a pro-life president, if he were writing those talking points to prepare the president for a debate, for a press conference, for the offhanded question on that issue, what would those points look like? Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Scott Klusendorf, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Good afternoon. Let's say for the sake of argument, I'm a woman, mid-50s, married, middle class, kids grown, out of the house, husband getting somewhat near retirement. I can still put up with him. I have my minivan. I have my maybe my Bible study group. I'm an average person.
What? I'd say sell the minivan and go on a cruising career. No, I know.
What can I do to stop abortion?
Yeah, great question, Todd. I think there's three key words for all of us to consider, whether we are the 50-year-old empty nester or, you know, we're still in our 20s just finishing up school. Here are the three words I think we all need to embrace. The first is master. The second is engage. And the third is initiate. And let me explain what I mean briefly by each of those. First of all, the ordinary person who wants to be effective on the pro-life issue needs to master the pro-life position. That means they need to learn what the debate is about. And once you master the intellectual framework, so to speak, of what's going on in the culture and debates over abortion and embryonic stem cell research and cloning, once you have a handle of that, you know the lay of the land, you are much more confident to speak to people. But you won't be confident if you don't know what the big issues are. And let me just outline for you the two big questions that are going on right now, whether the issue is abortion or embryonic stem cell research or cloning. The first question is, what is the embryo? What is the unborn? Is it a human being? Is it just a mass of tissue? You know, what is it? And then secondly, what makes humans valuable? That question is more and more coming to the forefront. In fact, I've got a book in front of me right now by an author by the name of David Boonin, who argues, he's a philosopher at the University of Colorado, he says, look, pro-lifers are correct. You and I are identical to the fetus or embryo we once were. In other words, David Boonin, the adult philosopher, is the same being as David Boonin, the embryo. However, it doesn't follow that David Boonin, the embryo, had the same right to life or the same value as David Boonin, the adult. Now, this is an amazing concession, Todd, because someone is arguing that, you know, the pro-life premise, the major premise that we're identical to the fetus as we once were is correct, and yet still saying it's okay to kill that embryo or fetus because it doesn't have the same right to life you and I do. Now, that is a serious philosophical challenge that's starting to creep up. And it's going to, you know, what starts in the academy ends up becoming something that we hear also in the marketplace of ideas where we work and where we go to school. So these are things we need to know about.
You said the second is engage.
Yeah, the second issue is engage. Once we know what the big issues are, you know, and the big issues center around the question, what is the unborn, what is the human embryo, and then over the question, what makes us valuable. And once we know those issues, then we need to engage. And that means we begin having discussions with people. When we hear the issue come up, we don't sit by and think, oh, I've got nothing intelligent to say. I'm going to engage this. We start writing letters to the editor of the paper. We start calling our congressman. we start speaking up at our churches and asking our leadership and our pulpits to take responsibility on these kinds of issues, that becomes then a way for us to go from merely thinking and feeling about an issue to taking some steps to be active. And then thirdly, I think the word I chose here is initiate. Some might want a stronger word like provoke, but I prefer initiate. That means where you go out of your way to start discussions on an issue like abortion. You don't just wait for the conversation to come to you. You ask intelligent questions to get people talking about it. You might, for example, say to someone, hey, you know, there's a lot of talk in the news today about cloning, and what do you think it is that makes human beings valuable? What would make something like cloning wrong? And start a discussion with people. And once you do that, you know that you're confident in what you believe. It gives you a chance to be gracious and yet incisive in what you believe. And that's what we as Christians need to do if we're going to be salt and light in the culture.
Now, I'm thinking again, or at least I'm trying to think again, as that average person who says, you have given me an awful lot to do, and this might take me months or years to bone up to the level that I need to be able to answer everyone's questions or answer everyone's objections to when I engage, and then I'm actually out there bringing the subject up myself. How do you respond?
Yeah, I understand that, and what my goal was for today's interview was to give people what they needed to begin mastering the pro-life position. In other words, we're going to get them 25% of the way there before we're done talking on the air today.
So where do we begin?
We begin with the question, what is the embryo? And I'll tell you why that's important, because there's a lot of distortion out there. You listen to people like Christopher Reeve, the actor, Michael J. Fox, and others who are arguing in favor of embryonic stem cell research, which, by the way, in case any of your listeners are unfamiliar with that, that is where we take a human embryo that we have conceived in a test tube. We grow it to about the 14-day stage, and then we kill it so we can extract its stem cells, the stem cells being the basic building blocks of the body. And then we take those stem cells and we transplant them into the bodies of people that are suffering from illness with the idea that somehow these cells will magically cure them of disease. Now, keep in mind there's no evidence that this is going to happen, but people nonetheless are saying that anybody who opposes embryonic stem cell research is just cruel and wants people to suffer needlessly. And I think we as pro-life Christians need to be able to answer that. We need to say, no, we don't want people to suffer. That's not what we're about. But we don't think the right way to relieve suffering is to kill innocent human beings. And if the unborn, or the embryo in this case, is an innocent human being, then to kill it to use its body parts to treat others is clearly evil. Now, we've got to make that case. And what's happening, Todd, is people are saying, oh, the embryo is not an individual human being yet, because after all, there's still the possibility at the 14-day stage that the embryo could twin. It could split and form two embryos. And so, therefore, it's wrong to say it's an individual human being. Well, of course, this is a popular argument, but it doesn't work, because just because an entity may split doesn't follow from that that it wasn't an individual whole human being prior to that split. If you take a flatworm and cut it in half, what do you get? You get two flatworms. So it doesn't follow that an organism can't be a living individual being just because the potential is there for it to split and form two beings. These are the kinds of questions we need to be able to answer. And the straightforward scientific answer to the question, what is the unborn, is simply this. From the earliest stages of development, the unborn are distinct, living, and whole human beings. That's a fact of science. That is not a personal religious view. That is simply a straightforward scientific reciting of the facts. And we as Christians need to be clear on those facts. That's a very simple fact that every one of your listeners can memorize before we even end this conversation.
Scott Klusendorf is our guest, Director of Bioethics for Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. We're talking about what the average person can do to stop abortion. If you'd like to join us, our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Scott, the second thing that we probably need to deal with then, if we're going to give them that 25% preparation that they need, is answer the second question, what makes human beings valuable in and of themselves.
Yeah, and that is where the real controversy is. The latest shift, Todd, in the debate over abortion is quite troubling. Here's how it used to go. It used to go people argued that the unborn were only potential human beings, or they were a different kind of thing from what the newborn is or the adult is. That has now changed. A lot of the more sophisticated abortion rights advocates are saying that you and I are indeed identical to our former fetal selves, but we didn't have the same right to life then that we do now. And I mentioned David Boonin earlier as one example of this. Well, as Christians and as pro-life advocates, that raises a number of interesting questions. Well, what makes us valuable in the first place? It used to be kind of a self-evident claim of most human beings that humans had value simply because they're human. I mean, after all, that is the foundational premise of Western civilization. It certainly is the foundation that undergirds our laws and our social customs. But now people are throwing a very skeptical eye at that assumption and saying to us as pro-lifers, you need to argue for that. You need to give reasons why humans are valuable simply because they're human. It's not good enough for you to simply assert that. Well, I don't think that objection works, because I think humans do have value in and of themselves, and that squares with our basic moral intuitions that we understand without even having to offer a reason for it. To give you an example of what I mean, if I said to you, it's wrong to torture toddlers for fun, you wouldn't say to me, well, give me a reason why that's wrong. You would say, yeah, that's right. And if you said, no, it's not right, I wouldn't say to you, oh, I need to give you an argument. I would say to you, oh, Todd, I need to find you a psychologist, because if you somehow think that's not wrong, a good argument isn't going to help you at this point. This is self-evidently true that we shouldn't torture toddlers for fun. And most people up until recently would have said the same thing about human beings in general. They would have said human beings are valuable for the kind of thing they are, and we don't need to offer any additional justification. But that has now changed in favor of a new view called personhood ethics. Personhood ethics says that there can be a human being, but then there's a person, and it's the person that has the right to life, not the human being. Do you see the distinction there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sadly.
Yeah, exactly. And so, for example, what makes a person valuable, according to this view? Their immediate capacity for self-awareness or self-consciousness, and if you don't have that, you're not a person. You may indeed be a living being. You may indeed be the same kind of being you will be once you're an adult, but you have no value because you don't have personhood. And personhood, in this case, is an accidental property. Now, here's why this doesn't work. Anything you pick out as the decisive factor for personhood, let's say it's self-awareness, anything you pick out will not only be arbitrary and ad hoc, it will also fail to account for human equality in general. Because if we're valuable as humans because of our level of self-consciousness or self-awareness, it follows that those that have more self-awareness are more human than those of us who have less. And you can just take the Declaration of Independence and throw it on the ash heap of history, because I don't know how you're going to account for human equality using that kind of reasoning.
Now, that's, interestingly enough, the very direction my thought was headed as I was listening to you there, Scott. And that is, and it's a question I've been rolling around in my head. It seems almost ludicrous to ask in the present day and age, but I was talking recently with Hadley Arkus, architect of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act. And I said, maybe we should be asking whether or not the unborn at every stage of development are our fellow citizens. In other words, do the protections of the Constitution and U.S. law in any way extend to them at every stage of development? Because it seems as though the foundational documents of our nation, to speak only as a citizen, don't make a distinction between human beings and persons. They simply say all men are created equal.
Yeah.
And are endowed with rights.
Yeah, I bet you hardly, I can't speak because I didn't hear the conversation, but I'm willing to bet that Hadley said that was the wrong way to go.
No, actually, he said precisely.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well,
that's
what
interesting.
He didn't want to put a fine point on the citizenship thing.
Yes, that's the issue I was,
But what? Right. But the failure of the Constitution and our foundational documents and our laws until quite recently to distinguish between persons and human beings, this is an innovative concept that has never seen the light of day.
That's
in American jurisprudence.
That's right, because as soon as you start saying there can be human beings on one hand and persons on the other, what happens is persons becomes an arbitrary category we invent to disqualify human beings we want to use for our benefit. And it removes the foundation of natural rights that America was founded on. And in fact, Hadley has written just a marvelous book on natural rights called Natural Rights and the Right to Choose. And as I'm sure your listeners remember from hearing the interview, he asked the question, well, if a woman has a right to an abortion, when did she get that right? And if it's a natural right, meaning a right you have simply in virtue of being a human being, which is what a natural right is defined as, it's a right that the government doesn't give you, rather you have it intrinsically because of the kind of thing you are, a human being. Well, Hadley raises a very good point. He says, abortion advocates argue that women have a natural right to an abortion. Well, if that's true, when did they get this natural right? Hadley concludes they get it from the moment they begin to exist. Well, when did that happen? Conception, which means according to the abortion advocate's own logic, every woman has a natural right to have an abortion from the moment she's conceived. So you can see how he has really turned the tables on abortion advocates, and I think his discussion of natural rights is right where we need to be going, and that is we need to argue that humans have value simply because they're human, because of what they are, not because they acquire this accidental property that we invent called personhood.
Scott Klusendorf is our guest. Let's go to the phones and talk with Ruthie, who's calling from St. Louis. Ruthie, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, thanks for my call. I love the focus on abortion. I just think it's so important for our day. I just had a comment and then a question. My comment is that Lutherans for Life has wonderful pro-life material for post-abortive women and women deciding to have abortions that you can pass out at clinics if you feel led to do that. And then my question is, my cousin is a Christian, and he says he's pro-life, but he's not against abortion at the beginning because he says the Bible says the life is in the blood, and until a baby has a blood system, it's not a life yet. Could you help me with that?
Well, if that's true, anybody undergoing a blood transfusion loses personhood while they replace blood with other blood, and I would not want to reduce human value to a blood transfusion. So his argument has some very counterintuitive implications to it. Also, I think there's a real danger in Scripture in looking for one verse to make your case. And I think there's a great way to argue from the Bible that the unborn are, in fact, creatures that should be protected, and that would be God's instruction for us. But I don't go about it, Ruthie, the way that most pro-lifers do. Most pro-lifers go running to Psalm 139, Jeremiah 1:5, Luke chapter 1, and they start looking for examples of Scripture alluding to the unborn being human beings like us. I don't think we should go that way because it's too easy for our critics to call those passages into question because they're largely poetic and they're mostly indirect. I think what we ought to do is simply say the following. The Bible teaches that all human beings have value because they're made in God's image. That is unequivocal in Scripture. Genesis 1:26-27, Genesis 9:6, Exodus 23:7, Matthew 5:21 would be, James 3:9. I mean, these are just some of the examples. The Bible also teaches that not only do humans have value because they're made in God's image, but that it's absolutely wrong to take innocent human life without justification, hence your commands against the shedding of innocent blood. Exodus 23:7, Proverbs 6:16-19, Matthew 5:21, to name just a few verses. Now, here's what we know. We know that all human beings have value because they're made in God's image, and we know that the shedding of innocent blood is wrong. Now comes the question, what does the Bible say about abortion or about the unborn? Answer, not much. You're not going to find a command in Scripture that says, thou shalt not have an abortion. You're also not going to find unequivocal teaching that the unborn are human. And you know what? None of that matters. Does the Bible teach anywhere that the French are human? No. Does it teach Canadians or Americans are human? No, but we know they are valuable in God's sight because in Colossians, in the first chapter, we're told that God desires to have relationship with men everywhere and draw all men to himself. These are scriptures that indicate that if the unborn are human beings, they too are valuable in God's sight, and they have intrinsic moral worth because of the kind of thing they are. And the facts of science, as I mentioned a moment ago, make it unbelievably clear that from the earliest stages of development, the unborn are distinct, living, and whole human beings. That's all we need to know. Once we know that the unborn are indeed human beings, the same passages that forbid the shedding of innocent blood in one context would apply to the unborn as well.
Now, Scott, we've got 2 minutes and no more than 2 minutes. My final question has to do a little more timely. We're in the presidential campaign, obviously. President George W. Bush is pro-life. He probably is going to try to avoid the issue of abortion, as everyone seems to want to avoid it, but it will come up. If you were putting together three talking points, or however many you want to do here in 2 minutes, for George W. Bush for the next 10 months going up to the election on the issue of abortion, what would they be?
Well, first of all, if listeners go to our website, which they can link to through yours at issuesetc.com, or issuesetc.org, there's a link to str.org, and I've got an article there in the bioethics section on my advice to George W. Bush. But very briefly, here's what I would argue. I would look at the Democrats and say to the American people, my view of humanity is inclusive. My view of humanity is that we should not discriminate on the basis of size, level of development, environment, or degree of dependency, and that all human beings, regardless of their varying stages of development, race, gender, or appearance, should be included in the human family and treated as valuable human beings. My opponents on the Democratic side, they believe that only strong and independent people have a right to life. I believe that all humans, including the weakest and most vulnerable amongst us, have a right to life. And as president, I will fight for that. I think that's a winning message. I think that resonates with people. And most importantly, it communicates the moral logic of the pro-life view.
Well, you know, if I could have one wish on this beautiful winter afternoon, it would be that George W. Bush would take your advice and then take the issue to his opponents.
And he might, Todd, because in the past he has articulated the moral logic very well. I wouldn't be so sure that he won't this time around, too. I'm a little more hopeful, maybe, than you might be.
Well, very briefly, from what you see of the people he surrounded himself with, do you think he's well-advised on the life issue?
Yeah, he surrounded himself with people like Hadley Arkus, who you mentioned, Robert George at Princeton University. These are great guys to have advising him on issues like this. And when I've heard him speak on issues like abortion and cloning, he has articulated a very clear moral logic for the pro-life view. And I think in a second term, you could see some real progress made.
Scott Klusendorf, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
Scott Klusendorf is director of bioethics for Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. He has written some great pro-life articles, and they're posted on Stand to Reason's website. He mentioned it before. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the section Links with Regular Guests, you're going to find a direct link to Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason. Or if you'd like to receive their free Solid Ground newsletter, you can call Stand to Reason at 1-800-2-R-E-A-S-O-N. That's 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. When we come back from this break, Congressman John Shimkus of the 19th Congressional District in Illinois joins us. He was there last night at the State of the Union address. He'll give us his review.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Why, O Lord, have you rejected me? Why do you hide your face from me? These words from Psalm 88 and other psalms like it can be deeply troubling to Christians. Not only do these psalms portray God as distant and indifferent, but they also sound a clear note of complaint. How should we understand these complaint psalms? Our first Issues Etc. book of the month for 2004 is called When God Becomes My Enemy, The Theology of the Complaint Psalms. For more information about this book, go to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on our Issues Etc. book of the month for January, When God Becomes My Enemy. Or to order the book, call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. When you call or write, mention Issues Etc. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. It's the Issues Etc. book of the month for January, When God Becomes My Enemy.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. It appears Congress is getting more liberal. The American Conservative Union looked at the voting records of our federal lawmakers and says as a whole, conservatives are moving left. Keith Peters has the story.
The ACU looked at 24 House votes and 19 Senate votes on issues such as partial birth abortion, budget resolutions, the nomination of Miguel Estrada, and the prescription drug benefit. Congressman Mike Pence of Indiana was one of only two in the entire Congress to score a 100% conservative rating. He says the ban on partial birth abortion was one of the big positives.
This was literally the first legislative victory in a 31-year history of this debate, and I don't think the importance and significance of that as a beginning of reversing the tide of abortion in America can be overstated.
But he also says conservatives need to do some serious soul searching on the size and the scope of the federal budget.
As we look at the expansion of entitlements, the expansion of the federal government's role in education, as well as overall spending, Republicans would do well to hew to their roots and come back to the core commitment that Republicans have to limited government and fiscal discipline.
Phyllis Schlafly of Eagle Forum says that may involve keeping a very close eye on President Bush's policies.
He is more inclined to compromise with the Democrats and go along with them on a lot of issues that are important to conservatives.
The issue that lost many conservatives their high ranking was their approval of the Bush Medicare prescription drug plan. For Family News in Focus, I'm Keith Peters in Washington.
Many are calling the prescription drug plan one of the biggest entitlements since the New Deal. Mike Schwartz of Concerned Women for America says the drug plan alone will saddle future generations with an enormous tax burden. He says that's one of the things conservatives will have to undo. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
There's people in your life that really don't need anything new, but you still want to honor them on their special occasions. Well, you could do it by becoming an AM850 KFUO Day Sponsor. Birthdays, anniversaries, whatever you're celebrating, do it with a day sponsorship. You'll get five announcements on that special day. For more information, call Janelle Flerke at 1-888-930-4438 and become an AM850 KFUO Day Sponsor and help support the ministry.
Is it a sin to complain to God? Find out with our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, When God Becomes My Enemy. For more information, check out our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $19.99 plus shipping and handling. When God Becomes My Enemy, an in-depth study of the Complaint Psalms, 1-800-325-3040. Or browse before you buy, issuesetc.org.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production salaries and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172. Or you can donate by check, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., what does it mean to be human? We were just talking about this in a brief way with Scott Klusendorf. One of his good friends, Frank Beckwith, will join us of Baylor University to answer that question tomorrow on the program. Also, Jesus only in our preaching, teaching, and serving. Dr. James Kaltoff, president of the Missouri District of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, will be our guest tomorrow on Issues Etc. For the first part of this, I'm sorry, for the remainder of this hour, or at least for the better part of the remainder of this hour, Congressman John Shimkus has been kind enough to join us of the 19th Congressional District in Illinois to give us his review and impressions of President Bush's State of the Union address last night. You saw it on television. You may have heard it on the radio or you may have read excerpts in the paper. Congressman John Shimkus, thank you for joining us. Welcome again to Issues Etc.
It's always a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Congressman, tell us about the atmosphere on the floor of the House chamber where everyone assembles, Senate and House and everyone in Washington, at a State of the Union address.
It's really a special time. It's a ceremonial time. It's a throwback, a remembrance of our Constitution and the separation between the branches, where the legislative branch invites the executive branch to come to our house, not his house, our house, which is the Congress, the people's house, and address the nation as to the State of the Union. And I've now sat through quite a few of them. They're just really emotional times. Now I've done enough where I'm enjoying them more, because you make friendships on both sides of the aisle. You know the issues better. You can see all the other interactions and interplays of members. I think TV tries to do that by panning, you know, the assembled members, but it doesn't do it justice, as you know, you can watch individual members, whether they're supporting or not supporting, and smiling or frowning, and we got to keep it all in perspective. But it's great theater.
You've got the Supreme Court, all nine members. You've got the President, his entire cabinet, the Joint Chiefs of Staff. You have the entire Senate and the House of Representatives. I don't think I'm leaving anyone out. All three branches of government as they are filled there. What is security like for something like this?
Well, it was pretty tight. But, you know, I was ensconced in the area the whole time, and I probably don't have the appreciation that a visitor would have going through a couple layers of security. A lot of areas just cleared out, a perimeter built up, snipers on roofs and helicopters flying and guard dogs and explosive dogs sniffing all over the place. But it is the one time when you have, you know, the vast majority of elected federal officers in one location.
Now, one thing that one does strongly see, and this is kind of a trivial thing, but one does see, especially in the age of a televised State of the Union address, and that is a lot of applause lines, a lot of standing up and sitting down, standing ovations, things like that. You hear almost as much applause as you do speech.
Yeah. You know, I used to get really, and maybe it's just this year, and actually I didn't like that part for many, many years. And maybe because what really happens is when you have a Democrat as president, the speeches are usually fairly vague. So issues will get thrown out there that, in essence, everybody wants to somewhat be supportive of. But it's really in how you run the program or run the plan that really breaks the aisle down into the partisan sides. I mean, Republicans are really more private sector, competitive base. Democrats historically are kind of government run solutions. So whether it's education or health care, the basic premise is maybe a positive, let's fix this, but you always know that the devil's in the details, and so you may want to clap, but then you know, well, obviously the Democrats had that problem last night. The president floated out some good ideas, you know, addressing helping the uninsured, tax relief issues. They are forced to clap when they really didn't want to clap. So that's why it's a little more theatrical when you can watch the interplay in the room.
The president began his third State of the Union address last night on the issue of what he called the active defense of the American people, including things like the war in Iraq and the U.S. Patriot Act. What did the president have to say, and what were your general impressions of that?
Well, we are in, and people get tired of hearing it, we still have to be very, very vigilant. You know, the president talked through the various bombings that have occurred since September 11th. We don't want to get a false sense of security. We want to be very, very active. We've got trained professionals in international environments that are not safe trying to fight the war on international terrorism, and that's their job. That's what they're trained for, and that's what they're doing at great risk. We also have a Homeland Security that's supposed to be doing it here. We've been blessed that we haven't seen a major attack. There have been threats. We have responded, but we have to be continue to be vigilant. You know, the primary role of the federal government is the protection of its citizens. The Democrats try to downplay that there's a need for that anymore. I think the need is more than ever, and we'll all be held accountable if on our watch something happens again.
One of the most memorable lines, to my opinion, that the president uttered last night was this: last January, Iraq's only law was the whim of one brutal man. Today, our coalition is working with the Iraqi Governing Council to draft basic law with a Bill of Rights. Do you think he made the case for not only the war, but also our continued involvement there for as long as it takes until Iraqis are self-governing?
Well, I think the world is better off now than it was prior. I know that Iraqis are. That's not saying it's a place that a lot of people want to visit right now. I do have a friend who's not attached with the government or the military, who's over there for 3 weeks with an Iraqi friend. So I guess there are people going over there. When men and women are in harm's way, there's justifiable concern by the American public, and I'm never going to say that we shouldn't be watching this closely and reporting on that. We have a lot of work to do, but for the public to think that for some reason some society can't believe in freedom and democracy and the rule of law, this is what the president said, that is kind of elitist on our part to say that other societies can't desire for those fundamental human rights that we think God lays in the hearts of all men.
Another theme of the president's speech was the No Child Left Behind Act and the challenges it faces. He said at one point, I refuse to leave any child behind. What is the president saying in your reaction?
Well, you know, the No Child Left Behind has been under attack, but the reality is more dollars are going to public education at the federal level than ever before. It's another basic argument that the folks in the education community are realists and say, hey, look, you can't get 100%. That's perfection. We're not perfect. We can't do that. The legislators, the president understands that. But do you really want to be a person that sets lower expectations and goals, or do you want to say, you know, we need to strive for 100%? We don't want to let anyone behind. It's a cliche, but it really sets a mental position of that we're going to try to do our best to help everyone, not that, well, we're going to help 95%. How can then you be the part of the 5% that the government up on?
Another issue, and this one a bit controversial and very timely because the president just announced an initiative on immigration laws, what's sometimes called amnesty, although he said he's not for amnesty. But he mentioned the immigration laws and a reform of those. What do you think?
Well, he's responding to some of the concerns that many of us have raised since the initial proposal, which was the public doesn't want a immigration reform that provides amnesty to illegal immigrants. It sends the wrong message. It probably would encourage illegal immigration. And so he is trying to address a real problem in this country on forgeries on documents that there are credible employers, not the guys who are really abused. There are people abusing immigrant labor. They know they're hiring immigrants. There's credible employers who are hiring who they think are legal based upon the documents presented, but aren't. And these people are asking for help. So deep down inside, everybody knows that there's some problems that need to be fixed. Just blanket amnesty is not the answer. And obviously in that speech, he heard the outcry that came from throughout the country that to make sure it's not an amnesty program.
Congressman Shimkus, you're being very generous with your time with us today as we have this conversation. Can you spare another 10 minutes?
Yeah,
for us
I'm here.
Oh, great. That's good to hear. That's very good to hear. We're talking with Congressman John Shimkus of the 19th Congressional District in Illinois, getting a review of President George W. Bush's State of the Union address last night. He had some things to say about health care. Our nation's health care system, like our economy, is also in a time of change. Many have observed that this president has found a way to steal that issue from his opponents in a pretty effective way. What do you think?
Well, and I listened while before I came on to the taped interview on how probably I didn't score 100% with the American Conservation Union because of my health care vote. It's a great bill, and it's a great bill because it addresses a couple of things. It brings market approaches to an entitlement system. Never before have we started bringing market principles to an entitlement program, and this Medicare prescription drug bill does that. It does bring a new hefty burden to the government, but it also brings health savings accounts, which are going to inspire people for tax-free accounts for preventative health care costs. He also addressed an issue of tax-deductible premiums for catastrophic coverage on insurance. The biggest issue is the uninsured, about 40 million. We want to help them get coverage. That's a very conservative, market-oriented, competitive model approach versus, again, here's a perfect example of how the interplay goes in the chamber. Everybody wants to address the 40 million uninsured. Republicans, conservatives want a market-oriented approach. Democrats, more liberal members, want a government-run program, which is more efficient, which is a better means of delivery of the services. You know, the market wins out 9 out of 10 times, and that's where he has started addressing health care needs, which then people would say politically takes a major item off the political agenda.
On the theme of families, the president skipped through some really big issues in a cursory way. He talked about increasing drug enforcement within our schools, drug testing, didn't want our children's futures wasted on drugs. And then he got to something that has been a hallmark, I think even before he was elected, of his rhetoric, and that is federal funding for abstinence, genuine abstinence programs. He promises to double it in the budget that he will submit to Congress. Does it have a good chance?
It's always going to be a lightning rod for attacks by the more social liberal members. They're not going to want to see that. It's hard to argue with the success of the program. The successes we have are attributed to a lot of hard work. There'll be a majority in support of that position on the House floor. The question, well, what will happen on the Senate side? So we're glad he's doing it, and we hope that we can support him.
The president took up the issue of the Defense of Marriage Act, of course, the 1996 bill signed by President Bill Clinton, and the degree to which the principles therein are being eroded by what he is calling, and others, of course, are also calling, activist judges who he said are, quote, redefining marriage by court order without regard to the will of the people and their elected representatives. What was the president trying to say?
Well, he's saying that the courts, through their rulings, are changing the intent of the elected legislative body and changing the law. And it's kind of a formal way of saying what people are crying out for now is the constitutional amendment to define marriage. That's a response to the failure of the federal courts to heed public policy and law as passed by their elected representatives. And if that continues to erode the intent and the will of the people, then the constitutional amendment may be the way we have to go.
Now, on that issue, I'm having a hard time determining whether or not the president said he was for a constitutional amendment or whether he just said, look, it may have to come to this. He says the only alternative left to the people if judges continue forcing their arbitrary will upon the people would be the constitutional process. Do you read that as him pledging to get behind a constitutional amendment to define marriage?
Yeah, I think that what the president was trying to do was say to the socially conservative audience that the Defense of Marriage Act fixes the problem that we think has resulted from the states. There's been erosion of that. I acknowledge that. If it goes too far, then the recourse is a constitutional amendment. I think he implies that if the constitutional amendment would make its way through the processes, he would be supportive. But I also think it also implies that he would hope that the courts would stop its activism and just interpret the law as passed by the legislative branch and signed by the president.
Something the president said in the middle of the speech, a little akin with the international, the Iraq issue, was a bit of a defense for what people say was kind of his go-it-alone policy with regard to Iraq and snubbing the international community. How do you think he did in saying, look, this is an international effort, and there are times when America simply needs to, quote, lead the cause for freedom?
Well, it's tough to say that there's not international involvement when he read off a list of, well, I don't know, 15 countries, and there's 17 more that he could have read. And I think that was it proved its point. Could there be more involvement? Of course there could. But I obviously think the one of the best lines was, and it's really classic George Bush, and I think why people like him, and I think it's why people dislike him. He says what he believes that's on his heart, and the quote was, America will never seek a permission slip to defend the security of our people. In other words, it's our responsibility to defend our people. We're not going to have to go to France or Germany to ask them to do what we need to do to defend our own citizens.
And I thought it was, again, I agree, but very well put, when he continued by saying it's mistaken condescending to assume that whole cultures and great religions are incompatible with liberty and self-government. This seems to be a very broad response.
Well, yeah, and really, it's, I think it's historically accurate. As I talk to people, and they'll make that claim, and see, we want to think the best. We don't want to think the worst. We want to think that all people strive for basic freedoms and liberties. Imperial Japan after World War II had no connection with democracy, and the Asian culture is far different than Western European Judeo-Christian evolutionary rights and freedoms and liberties. But they have a strong democratic government that's lasted the test of time. So sure they can, but it's going to take diligence and hard work and persistence.
Congressman, the House has the responsibility of appropriating funds to fill the line items of this nation's budget, and it's been commented on quite a bit already today in reaction to the President's State of the Union that this is a pretty big price tag. Beyond the ideas, the amount of money he's proposing to spend for various things is mind-boggling. Does the price tag bother you?
Oh, sure. I mean, it should bother anybody. As a conservative, we don't have the conservative numbers yet in the House and the Senate to really move a pure conservative agenda. We have to keep our more moderate Republicans in the fold. That means we have to spend more money. It's just a reality until we grow enough conservatives to slow down. Look at the discretionary budget, the budget that we actually have control over, only grew, even with all the claims of pork barrel spending, only grew at 3%. That's what we budgeted. That's what we spent. The president wants this budget to grow 4%. And we've had problems with emergency spending for Iraq and Afghanistan and the reconstruction of the World Trade Towers and all that other stuff that occurred after September 11th. We had a declining economy, and we had tax relief to get the economy moving. That's why we have a great deficit. It's not one cause. It's three causes. For the federal government to grow at 3%, that's really not that great with respect to growth of other issues in the country.
Congressman, in an election year, how likely is it that major legislation will be passed between now and the end of 2004?
There's only a few pieces that we even think are possible. That being the highway bill, that would be considered major legislation. I think that, that will eventually be passed and signed into law sometime this year. Energy bill, which is another piece of major legislation, I think has less and less chance each day that we move forward.
Anything that you wish you would have heard that the president would have mentioned in the State of the Union address last night that he didn't mention?
I don't think so. I just appreciated the fact that he came before us and laid out provisions. I wasn't really looking for anything new. The new plans that he addressed are really small in dollars. There was no major new funding initiative, no billion-dollar thing here and there. We are getting pressure from the base to try to get the fiscal house in order, and I think he heard that, and so even his increased spending initiatives will easily be able to be met by moving dollars around and living within a 4% increase. So no, I wasn't expecting much more.
When November rolls around, Congressman, what will it take for President Bush to win your home state, Illinois?
Well, I think obviously one is for the election or not, we just need to pray that we're successful in keeping terrorists off our soils and nothing major would happen. We want to have success in the transition in Iraq, hopefully elections in June, and the economy's got to continue to grow. It's made great signs. There's been increase in jobs. Obviously, for all the right reasons, we'd like for that to grow so that people are more fully employed. And I think if Iraq seems to be calming down and the economy is growing, I think George Bush will do well in November.
Congressman John Shimkus, I know you got a lot of work ahead of you, not only as a legislator, but you guys are all running for office between now and November. Godspeed to you, and thank you for being our guest.
My pleasure. Take care, and keep up the great work.
Congressman John Shimkus of the Illinois Congressional District, the 19th there in my home state, too. We've been talking about the president's State of the Union address last night. Now, when we come back from this break, Peter LaBarba joins us for a few minutes in the third hour of Issues Etc. on two issues. One, an amendment to the Illinois Constitution that would ban same-sex marriage. It's being proposed from both sides of the Illinois legislative aisle. Also, criticism by gay activists leveled at the appointment of a former U.S. congressman, that's Glenn Pichard, to Southern Illinois University's Board of Trustees. We'll talk about both of those things, and then we'll be talking with Dr. Jeff Waltz about the Democratic presidential race in the third hour.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.